Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Cancer Now What Vodcast, brought to you by Arizona Center for Cancer Care. My name is Jenny, and I am so pleased to be in studio today to talk about a very important type of cancer, colon cancer, with three specialists in the area of colon cancer. Our first guest is Dr. Makarawo, who is with Colon and Rectal Center of Arizona. He's a colorectal surgeon. We have Dr. Frank Tsai with Arizona Center for Cancer Care and the Virginia G. Piper Cancer Care Network, our medical oncologist here today. And we have Dr. Daniel Moline, gastroenterologist with Arizona Digestive Health. Dr. Mack. Hello. Nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, of course. Do you want to take a minute and introduce yourself and tell our audience a little bit about what you do?
Okay. So I'm Dr. Tafadzo Makarawo, but everyone go by Dr. Mack, as it's probably easier to pronounce.
Much easier. Thank you.
I'm a colorectal surgeon. I'm based out in the West Valley. I've been in the West Valley for the last 5 years and primarily look after all things colon and rectal. So I guess the specialty is mostly relates to things that are related to the colon, such as diverticular disease, colon cancer, which probably fits with what we're talking about today, anal rectal disease like hemorrhoids and anal fissures. So really, that's kind of the wide spectrum of things that I look after.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being here. Dr. Tsai, welcome. Good to see you again.
Same here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, your specialty, and where you practice.
My name is Frank Tsai. I'm a medical oncologist and hematologist. My office is located at the Shea Hospital of Honor Health. And even though we're talking about colon cancer, I see a variety of different cancer types and blood-related issues.
Okay, great. Well, we definitely can't wait to hear what you have to say, for sure. Thank you. And Dr. Moline, gastroenterology, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm Daniel Moline. I practice in North Scottsdale. I'm a gastroenterologist and hepatologist, so a lot of people think that I just do butts, but I do guts and butts.
Got it.
So everything that's not your kidneys, your lungs, or your heart falls into my domain, the whole digestive disease spectrum.
Okay, great. So all three of you play a very important part in the treatment and diagnosis and prevention of colon cancer and rectal cancer. And with it being March, it's Colon Cancer Awareness Month. We really wanted to make sure that we had all the expertise available to help us understand why it's important to know and be aware of the different sides and treatments of colon cancer. So I'll start with you, Dr. Moline, if that's okay. Really, I'm imagining that you have your primary care physician. Your primary care physician does their annual checkup and they say, okay, you are 45 years old, right? Because we changed the screening age to 45 from 50. It's time to see a gastroenterologist. Is that when you enter the scene? Or there, I'm sure also if there's any issues, when does a person see a gastroenterologist?
Well, we hope that's when they see me at 45, because 45 is the new 50. And that's when the explanations start. Well, my grandmother lived to be 100, and I eat quinoa every day, and I do yoga and Pilates and Peloton, and I'm not overweight, and I don't smoke, and I don't need to see a gastroenterologist. I'm fine. So the time to see us is when you have no symptoms at 45.
Okay. And what kind of symptoms would make it so that someone had to come see you before 45, before it was time for their start their annual screenings?
Oh, that's a great question, Jenny. Not all bleeding is hemorrhoids, and even intermittent bleeding. So usually if there's any blood of any type, a patient should at least have a consultation and evaluation.
Okay, so the symptoms then people should be looking for are blood in their stool. Anything else? Is the appetite change? What are some of the other symptoms that they want to be on the lookout for?
What I tell my patients generally, and I use mammograms as an example, you don't wait for a breast lump to do a mammogram. So as far as screening colonoscopies is concerned, you don't wait till you're having symptoms. But if you're younger than 45, it would be unexplained change in bowel activity, unexplained weight loss, any type of blood noted in the stool or feces, Sometimes referrals from Dr. Tsai if somebody has iron deficiency or anemia or fatigue or just general not well-being. But the symptoms of colon cancer are very vague, and they usually don't present till later in presentation.
I see. So then this is another example of one of those cancers that if you catch it early, you have a much better chance of getting through it and beating it, I'm assuming.
Absolutely.
And so we go to you to make sure we catch it early.
Right.
Got it. Okay, that's helpful. So what are some of the ways that people can protect themselves besides colonoscopy and prevent colon cancer?
Well, there's some controversy, but weight is a big factor. People who are overweight tend to have more breast cancer, more colon cancer. People who are not the healthiest eaters may be more prone. But especially people with risk factors, such as parents or siblings or relatives with polyps or ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, or patients who have family history of colon cancer. But I've even diagnosed colon cancer and certainly polyps in vegetarians who are healthy people. So I tell patients, you can't eat colon cancer away. I don't care how much broccoli and kale you eat and how much probiotics you take. You're not going to completely prevent it. There's also, beyond the scope of today's conversation, some new information that higher vitamin D levels may be somewhat preventative. And aspirin has been tossed around for years and years as potentially helpful in preventing recurrence of polyps or progression to advanced cancer.
That's great.
But simply, the best thing to do is just get screened. And the nice thing about colorectal screening is that it sort of has a pay-it-forward guarantee. Unfortunately, when you get a mammogram, it takes a picture of your breast that day and tells you if you have something suspicious to worry about. But you could develop breast cancer weeks or months later. Mm. But when you come and you have a good, clean colonoscopy with Dr. Mack or myself, the chance of you getting colon cancer in the next 5 years is infinitesimally small, and the next 10 years is very unlikely. So the best thing to do is just check the box, get it done, and then not worry about it for 5 to 10 years.
For sure. And everybody's heard of other types of screenings instead of, no one likes the prep, right? No one wants to drink whatever it is to prep for the colonoscopy. No one wants to go through the procedure. So I'm sure there's lots of companies out there that are trying to find other ways, and we see them on television, right? We see their ads. What are those effective? Are there other ways to screen and prevent cancer?
Yes, there are. There's always been recommendation of doing a FIT test, a fecal immunotest, every year. That's still available and still on the recommendation of the United States Preventative Task Force. I think people are very, very aware of the dancing blue box on the Super Bowl commercials.
That's the one I was thinking of.
And most people would rather poop in a box and give it to their mailman than have to have diarrhea and not eat and have a colonoscopy. And I would much rather have somebody do the Cologuard test if that's the only test they're going to do and nothing at all. But I don't believe that Cologuard is a true substitution for colonoscopy. For example, there is a 10% false negative and a 10% false positive accepted rate with Cologuard. And that would be if you came to my office and I said, Jenny, I'm going to do your colonoscopy. I'm pretty good at what I do. I only miss 1 out of 10 cancers.
Goodbye.
I think you'd leave.
Goodbye.
I catch 99.9% of cancers. So colonoscopy is really the gold standard, has been the gold standard all along. But Cologuard is an alternative.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. So, Dr. Mack, I'm going to turn to you because I know you're doing screening also and prevention. And what are the things in the surgical world how are you managing patients from a prevention standpoint?
So, much like Dr. Molina is just describing, a lot of it is counseling and education. A lot of the time patients come with a lot of misconceptions about risk factors, things that put them at risk for developing it. So a lot of it is down to instructing them on things that improve their risk, including diet-related things, exercise-related things, and then just following a schedule. So once you reach the time when you're due for colonoscopy, which is at this moment 45, then that's when you should have your colonoscopy done. And then obviously following up subsequently based on what the previous colonoscopies find. So if there's any polyps that are identified, then being vigilant to make sure that you follow up with your additional colonoscopies as needed. So a lot of it is just counseling. And clearly there are occasions when patients do come in with symptoms, and then that's when it's a little bit more concerning and I really kind of have to drill down on having the appropriate tests.
Okay. So Dr. Moline mentioned that, you can get your colonoscopy from him or from someone like you, Dr. Mack. What is the difference really in the work of a gastroenterologist versus a colorectal surgeon? Like, how does the work? I know one of you is doing a lot of cutting because the word surgeon's in it, right? But can you help us understand the difference in those two specialties?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of overlap. Our training pathways are different in that one is medically based, and then one is based through the surgery pathway, but both are within both are subspecialties of both. And so the overlap is in terms of the basic management of certain conditions can be done by both. More elaborate management of conditions that involve medications such as inflammatory bowel disease and IBS tends to be more gastroenterology based versus the application of surgical techniques. So once you get into doing a surgical procedure, then that's when you have colorectal input. But I think that in terms of the goals, I think the goals are the same. I think that's maximizing gut health. And I think that where there's overlap is our principles of prevention are the same. It's just the differences are just the use of medications leans more towards gastroenterology. Certainly the more advanced endoscopic techniques, again, lean more towards gastroenterology as well, versus surgical procedures are more in our realm. Colorectal surgery.
So what determines if a patient needs a surgical approach versus an endoscopy or a colonoscopy or a different kind of approach?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's a lot of collaboration. There have been several occasions where if there's evidence of either a complex polyp or a polyp that is not easily identifiable or corrected, from an endoscopic perspective, that's when surgery would intervene. But there are also times when it can be managed by a gastroenterologist without the need of surgery. So there's certainly a lot of collaboration with colleagues, and that's when it's important to have a good relationship, because the goal is that not every condition has a one-size-fits-all approach. So I think there's a lot to be said for being able to discuss. And then there are certain situations where if it's, fully diagnose cancer, then that can only be corrected with surgery. Then that's when you need an abdominal approach.
Sense. Anything to add, Dr. Moline?
Part of my job is to keep patients away from both of my colleagues here. I think of myself as being in the colon cancer prevention business rather than the colon cancer detection business. But I agree with you completely. So much of it is educating our parents and even our patients and even educating our primary care physicians as well. But when I do find a cancer, and I hope I don't, that's when I call
send over to
Frank,
these guys.
And that's when I call Taffy, yep, and say, hey, I need your help.
Got it. Okay, that's great. Well, and I have to say, it's so comforting to hear you both say that and share that. And I know we'll get to Dr. Tsai in a minute, and I know that he definitely will say this as well. But the level of camaraderie and the way that you all communicate, right? I don't think patients necessarily always know what goes on behind the scenes when it comes to the communications between their specialists in cancer care. And I love when I get to hear that you all are talking, well, this is when I grab this guy and this is when we text this one. And so I think it's so important for our viewers to know how much you talk behind the scenes and that you communicate with each other to make sure that the patient's getting the right treatment. So yeah, thank you for that. So Dr. Tsai, if medical oncologist, right? So the medical treatment of cancer in all things, right? Mm-hmm. What do you do if you get diagnosed with colon cancer?
So it's a very difficult time. It's a very, very emotionally stressful time. You really want to have a team who is experienced in dealing with this type of disease. And colon cancer really is, or we should say colorectal cancer, really is one of those cancers that requires a multidisciplinary approach. It's not just Dr. Moline's expertise, it's not just Dr. Mack's expertise. Because very often with colon cancer, we may require chemotherapy after the surgery that decreases your chance of the cancer coming back. With rectal cancer, you may even require radiation and chemotherapy beforehand, before the surgery, to decrease the chance of the cancer coming back. And so so you really want to surround yourselves with a team that knows this disease.
Okay, got it. So if I am at my primary care doctor, I'm having symptoms, I go to my gastroenterologist, there's an issue, he calls you, or you, right? Depending on the situation. What is, and I'll ask Dr. Mack this one, what is the first thing that has to be done? Are there CAT scans? Is there more, like trying to get in more information? Is there blood work? Like, what is that? What's the first thing that happens?
So let me just get this correct. So the scenario is that the patient has just found out the diagnosis.
Yes.
And so I always invite them in and to meet with me if I've been directly involved with that diagnosis, because I think that there's a lot to be said about counseling. And as Frank alluded to, this is a moment that they're very vulnerable, so I don't take that for granted. And there's a lot of information that's going to be disseminated. So I think that's probably my number one go-to, spending time explaining what's going on, because in the age of information, there's so much information that's out there and a lot of misinformation as well. So I think that's always my first step. Beyond that, then it's a case of now rounding up the team. And it's very much a team approach. So, establishing if it's a rectal cancer, establishing who will need to get someone to be involved with the radiation if necessary, getting someone that is going to institute the chemotherapy if that's a necessary step. We talk about staging the cancer, which means that you have to go through a series of investigations which involve lab tests and imaging tests. So a lot of it will be now kind of pointing out directions as to where the patient will need to go to, but also getting the team involved and making them aware that the patient now needs further support. Once there's an idea of what the game plan is collectively, then we then proceed with it being whether it be chemo and radiation first or surgery, and then we go from there.
So how do you guys know if it's appropriate to have surgery before chemo or the other way around, Dr. Tsai?
It really depends on the particular cancer type. In general, colon cancer, for the most part, it's surgery first. And that's a standard approach. With rectal cancer, the standard tends to be chemo radiation before the surgery. But cancer doesn't follow textbook to the T. And this is why I really enjoyed Dr. Mack and Dr. Millene's participation at our tumor boards. We have some challenging cases. There are some ambiguous signs out there. And having that discussion at our tumor boards, where we all are in the same room, or at least pre-pandemically, and now much more so, to be able to discuss these challenging cases, then we can develop a plan together.
So I always hear physicians in the cancer world talking about tumor board. And I know what a tumor board is. I've actually got to see tumor boards in action. They're very, very cool. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions, though, because I don't think our general population knows what a tumor board is if you're not living in this space, right, or you've never been exposed. So can any physician in the community attend a tumor board? Like, I know you're putting up cases, right, for the pathologist and the radiologist and the surgeon and the medical oncologist and then all the different specialties, the gastroenterologist, all the specialties, to kind of talk about these cases to make sure that you're all figuring out the best way to help people. Can anybody attend? Like, if you're on the medical staff at the hospital, you can go. Like, how do you get the best minds in the room?
Yeah, so that's correct. If you're privileged at the hospital, then you can participate. The physician, we have nurse practitioners, physician assistants participate as well. And you'd be surprised at what you learn about your patients at the tumor board when the primary care doctor is there. There's always the little crumbs of clues about the patient that you pick up. Radiologist is there. The radiologist, there are more times than I can count that the radiologist points something out on the CT scan that may impact the patient's care. So the short answer to your question is yes.
That's amazing. And I really think that that's so important for people to understand, because we do talk about how you all are texting and talking and communicating with the patients that you share, but also to have the opportunity to look at all the scans together and to collaborate in a room with the other physicians involved in the care and try to think about, okay, how could we do this differently? Because every cancer is so different, right? In every different kind of body. So you can really talk about things that have worked for similar cases, different mm-hmm. cases. I'm a big fan of the tumor board.
And I think that's one of the great things about community programs like Dr. Mack's office and Dr. Millen's office, where I would see Dr. Millen down the hall and we can discuss a case without having to walk through a huge building where we never see each other. So I think that's where most cancer patients want to be treated, in the community.
Definitely. I love that. So Dr. Mack, can you talk us through, okay, so you've both mentioned that chemo is appropriate for colon cancer and surgery is appropriate for colon cancer. For rectal cancer, chemo, radiation, and surgery are all appropriate potentially, correct?
Potentially, and depend on the stage.
Right, okay. So can you talk us through what it is like for a patient to have colon surgery and what is the healing time for that? Are we using robotics? Are we not? You know, like all the different technologies that are involved. And then, you know, we hear that horrible, everybody doesn't want a colostomy bag. Like, is that a thing we can avoid? Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah. So I guess once we've gone through the process of coming to a decision about surgery, I think the first thing is I prepare the patient for what's ahead, because there's a lot, again, that they may have heard or spoken to other folks about surgery, so I try to prepare them for what's up ahead. And I like to use the analogy of a marathon, because that's a good way of kind of imagining what's expected. So I always tell them that when you're preparing for a marathon, there's nutrition that you've got to be prepared for. So if you're about to run a marathon, you're not going to go on an empty stomach. So make sure your nutrition's up to scratch as you prepare for surgery. And we're talking weeks in advance. I talk about conditioning, so being as active as possible, because those two things alone can make a huge impact on how they recover. We have a process where I interact with the physicians that have been looking after the patient up to that point, including what they call a medical clearance, which is more a discussion to be certain that the patient is prepared medically for surgery. So that all goes on at the same time. I offer them an opportunity once again to discuss the surgery so they understand what they're about to undertake. And then there's the surgery itself. In terms of approaches, you know, a lot of words get banded around: laparoscopic, robotic, open. These are just all approaches. All of these are available to a board-certified surgeon like myself, and it's just the choice is really up to what that board-certified surgeon thinks they can use to offer the best possible solution. So I'm very wary about offering one approach. I often tell them that any approach that's done in good hands is a good approach. I offer laparoscopic and robotic most of the time because it gives them a good chance of recovering quickly with small incisions. But sometimes not everybody's surgery can be done laparoscopically or robotically. So in some occasions, it may be necessary to do it through what they call an open procedure, which is an old-fashioned incision. But overall, the goal is to remove the cancer as a whole. And then we work on the second half. And I always talk about it in halves because the first half is the surgery, but a lot of patients have this conception that the surgery is the entire treatment or process, whereas the recovery is the second half of it. In other words, they've got to be able to eat food, tolerate that well, have good pain control, have good energy levels, be able to be reconditioned. These are all things that have to take place in that recovery phase. In terms of, and I think you made mention of the presence or use of an ostomy or a colostomy, and that is something that is occasionally necessary. And I often counsel patients that, you know, we don't offer colostomies or ostomies, you know, without careful consideration. I think it's often a necessary step and it's often a life-saving step. So I know it's not anyone's favorite, but that being said, there are several people in the community that live a normal life with an ostomy. And sometimes the ostomy is temporary and reversible, sometimes it's permanent, but the majority of the time the decision is made to make sure that they have a safe recovery from surgery.
That's great. Thank you so much. That's important information. So we talked about surgery and how we're handling the tumors with surgery. Tell us about the different types of medical treatments that we're using. Chemo, are we using immunotherapy? What are the differences? What's new and exciting in your world when it comes to colon cancer?
Yeah, so actually, Dr. Millie and Dr. Mack and I had a chance to talk about this a little bit, but one of the up-and-coming approaches is regarding rectal cancer. Traditionally, it's been with chemo radiation before the surgery, but there's been more and more data to suggest that doing chemotherapy first, followed by chemo radiation, then surgery, seems to improve the outcome. It's still controversial, but there's increasing data to show that adding chemotherapy ahead of surgery seems to help. And one of the reasons for that is because the chemo radiation has done such a good job in controlling the rectal cancer locally, most of the patients are actually dying from metastatic disease that has come back. And so the ability to bring that chemotherapy up front allows the patient to receive more treatment and decrease the chance of the cancer coming back.
Oh, that's amazing. So is that all in trial right now, or is it actually happening, or where are we with that?
There's actually several phase three clinical trials. Some trials have supported its approach, and other trials have shown that it did not validate, and so other additional studies are ongoing. But some colleagues are taking that approach, and some are taking more of a traditional chemo radiation approach.
Okay, great. I have one more question for you, Dr. Millie, if I might. So I'm thinking a lot about, so full disclosure, my father's a gastroenterologist, right? So I
How
don't,
convenient.
It's very convenient. And if I don't make him proud on this episode, I will never make him proud. But he has worked with a lot of cancer patients over the years. And I know, Dr. Tsai, your wife is also a gastroenterologist.
Yep.
And, there's a lot of conversation about when gastroenterology and those procedures, interventional procedures, should be done, right? Like there's, if somebody is severely ill and terminal, right? Like, are interventions appropriate? What are your thoughts on, as people become sicker, can gastroenterology really help them with symptom control, and when is it too much?
Well, we take a very individual approach with every patient.
Sure.
And one of the things that bothers me now is I'm calling patients back for their recalls. They've had tubular villus adenomas, a history of polyps, family history of polyps, and they're telling me, oh, I read in AARP that I'm 75, I don't need to do this anymore. And so there's, the guidelines are screening from age 45 to 75, but for example, my parents, my dad is 90 and my mother is 85, and they're probably in Spain or somewhere right now. I don't even know.
Oh, I love that.
They travel. They're very, very healthy. My dad's mother survived colon cancer in her 50s.
Wow.
My dad's father died at 69. My dad's sister is 95 and had colon cancer. So he has two parents, a sibling, and he's had polyps. And his primary care doctor would say, no, you don't need any more screening.
Because of his
but
age.
His life expectancy is going to be 100 years old. And maybe he should have a Cologuard test. But Cologuard doesn't pay for it after 85. So there is controversy over when we should intervene. So like Dr. Mack, and I'm sure Dr. Tsai as well, patients say, no, I don't need it. My doctor said I don't need it. I said, please come in, have a consultation. Let's do a telehealth visit. And let's talk about the pros and the cons. Now, if that person comes in with an oxygen tank and they have COPD and aspirin and or insulin pump and diabetes and three stents and they're on, blood thinners, then, I'm going to talk to them and say doing another colonoscopy or intervening is not likely going to improve your quality of life nor extend your quality of life. But when I have patients that are playing tennis and pickleball, and they're healthy and they have no comorbid disease, maybe it is appropriate to do one more colonoscopy for the road despite their age. So it's a very individual thing. Now, the other part of your question might have been, what do we do if somebody has really severe illness or disease or cancer? I may be done doing colonoscopies on them, but I'm certainly not done trying to provide them with care, whether it be palliative care, supportive care, because these patients, post-surgery, post-chemo, post-radiation, they have a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. Bleeding, gas, bloating, constipation, stomach aches, indigestion. So that's where the more medical approach of gastroenterology comes in. I love to do procedures, but I also treat the patient's symptoms after the diagnosis as well.
That's wonderful. Thank you. That's such important perspective, especially around 75 years old. And, you know, I mean, my gastroenterologist father is 73, and I promise
he's still eligible.
Still getting his colonoscopies, and he will continue to get them as long as there's breath in his body, I'm sure. So, well, thank you all so much. Before we wrap up, is there anything, I'll start with you, Dr. Mack, anything else you want our viewers to know when it comes to colon cancer? Anything that people are asking you that you want to share?
You know, more than anything else, I can't emphasize this enough. I think that the embarrassment of having someone talk to you about the condition, having someone examine you, really should not prevent you from having something done that could be life-saving. So I can't say it enough. I can't emphasize it enough. Please don't, you know, don't allow something that's life-threatening, you know, affect you just because of those kinds of issues. Do see a specialist if you need to.
Absolutely. That's great advice. Thank you. Dr. Tsai, anything you want to leave us with?
You know, there are very few cancers that we can truly screen for in an effective way, and this is one of them. So just go and do it.
I'm definitely going to make my appointment. And Dr. Moline, are you taking new patients? Because I need to make my appointment. And do you have a female in your practice? That's and I saw the list. You do. Good. Yes. Okay, good.
Again, I agree with my colleagues. Colorectal cancer is the number two cancer killer in this country for men and women. It's happening to patients at younger and younger ages. We're seeing a bump and an increase in millennials and Gen Xers. Sooner or later, we're going to get you in the end. It's much better to come sooner and be preventive about this. This is one of the few totally preventable cancers we have.
Great. Great advice. Well, thank you all so much for being here. I really appreciate it, Dr. Mack, Dr. Tsai, and Dr. Moline. If you'd like more information on any of the conversation that we've had today, you can visit for Dr. Mack. You can visit him at crcaz.com. That's Colon and Rectal Center of Arizona, crcaz.com. For Dr. Moline, you can visit him at Dr. Moline, drmeline.com. Or for Dr. Tsai, you can visit him at arizonaccc.com. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.